slavery was our worst idea. I'm not sure I'd put prohibition second, but it's really up there.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker whose latest project is out. It's about prohibition. Ken, thanks for talking to Reason TV.
My pleasure.
Why is prohibition in vogue these days? It seems between your documentary, Dan O'Krent's book from 2010, there seems to be a real interest in this period and re-examining it.
I think there's always a superficial interest in prohibition. You know, you've got gangsters. Everybody wants to be able to kill the people who piss them off. You've got women who are seemingly promiscuous, the flapper dancing with the short skirt and the bobbed hair on top of the tables. But I think in every case, Dan's book, Boardwalk Empire, and our film, it's the understanding that prohibition reveals a lot more. This is the story of single-issue political campaigns that metastasize with the most horrible unintended consequences, including creating organized crime, which we wouldn't have. This is about the demonization of recent immigrants. This is about a whole group of people who feel like they've lost control of their country and want to re-exert that control by imposing on these newcomers some new law. It sounds so familiar with today. It resonates with today's themes.
What are the parallels with today? I mean, is the parallel directly to the drug war?
No, I think it's less to that. I mean, alcohol is used by every culture since there have been human beings. Drugs are a subcultural thing. Alcohol was something everybody did, so eliminating it required a great act of faith to take place. Drugs are not favored by a majority of people, and so while there are lots of similarities and the possibility of taxing and regulating marijuana is a hugely interesting consideration, once again, it's unintended consequences. You have to be careful. I just think it's so much like our political moment. Lack of civil discourse, the demonization of immigrants, smear campaigns during presidential elections, all of this sort of single-issue campaigning, all of that stuff resonates with today because, in fact, human nature is the same. And prohibition brings out and reveals to us our essential dichotomy, not between us as much as within us, the generosity and the greed, the Puritanness and the purience, the sincerity and the hypocrisy, the Saturday night at the bar and the Sunday morning in church. And so that's always been America's torn on that tension.
Your previous documentary was about America's national parks, which you called America's best idea. Would you say prohibition was our worst?
It's close to being our worst. This is the slavery was our worst idea. I'm not sure I'd put prohibition second, but it's really up there. We, for the first time in our history, had an amendment which were usually about expanding human rights that actually restricted human rights. It was put in there, ironically, as an amendment because they thought it would be enshrined in the Constitution and therefore never be repealed. But of course, it's the only amendment that's been repealed, which shows that at least we have some intelligence and woke up to the hypocrisy.
And one of the themes of the documentary is that actually is also one of political overreach, that by actually trying to make it an amendment, it forced the issue in a way perhaps that it wouldn't have been?
I'm not sure it's overreach as much as it's sort of moral certainty, that the Dries were so certain that they were right, so self-righteous in their convictions, that when they were able to achieve through a completely fascinating political transformation of the country over the previous 100 years, they then refused to compromise an inch. And as it was clear that the law was ineffectively written, that it was clearly ineffectively applied and uneven and hypocritical, they didn't make adjustments. And because they didn't make adjustments, which might have at least prolonged prohibition for them, it then became just as easy to have it undone as it had seemed to have been created.
A lot of people talk about prohibition as, and this is certainly part of your argument in the documentary, as the kind of the rural America, small town America, conservative Protestant America, the established America going against new arrivals in cities. Your documentary also complicates that take by talking about the role that progressives played in pushing and maintaining and forcing prohibition. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, you have to start and say alcohol, drunkenness in the 19th century, was and is a terrific social problem. It is the obligation of a caring society to try to figure out what to do. So there were lots of different groups that wanted to do something about it, progressives as well as conservatives, the single issue anti-saloon league, plus all the other groups that wanted to do it, the international workers of the world, the Wobblies, the radical group, and the industrialists, the Ku Klux Klan and the NAACP. All of these people wanted it for various reasons, and I think nobody just ever thought it through what it would actually meant. They always thought it was prohibition for somebody else. Right. And when they woke up and found that the law used to administer the amendment, the Volstead Act, was draconian in the extreme, and that it had essentially invited organized crime, then I think we were on the road to disaster, and it took us nearly 14 years to undo that disaster.
One of the main voices in the documentary is Pete Hamill, the New York columnist and writer. He talks at the end, at the very end of the documentary, actually, about how one of the lessons of prohibition is the folly of trying to control people's behavior.
Yes.
Legislatively, prescriptively.
Never underestimate the need for young dopes to defy the conventional laws. You want something, you want them to brush their teeth, make it illegal. Make toothpaste illegal, and they'll be standing on the roof brushing away. It's natural to human beings. I think it's a healthy thing.
What are the ways, or what are the behaviors now, if you pull that impulse forward, that social conservatives on the one hand are trying to control, and progressives, and is there a straight line to draw through?
Oh, there's definitely a straight line through all of these panaceas, these magic bullets, these things that we can do that will make us a more perfect society. And I think actually one of the benefits of prohibition, despite this horrible inheritance of organized crime and all the other bad things it did, is that it gives us pause. When somebody comes and said, you know what we need is we need this amendment or we need that amendment, we just kind of go, wait a second, because the memory of prohibition and those unintended consequences are fresh. And so there are many, many things that you see within politics.
Don't we also live, I mean, we're speaking in New York City that in 2003 banned smoking in bars, and now more recently, earlier this year, banned it in outdoor spaces. We live in a world where children, what is allowed for children is being more and more prescribed. Are we just kind of taking on different targets that to our mind and our time seem fine without understanding, you know, certainly 800,000 people are arrested for marijuana possession a year. I mean, have we substantially changed?
No, I think we're always in pursuit of a more perfect union. And sometimes that pursuit involves trying to legislate activity. I won't even say morality, it's activity. You know, we legislate murder, we don't steal, we're not into pedophilia. So we're always in the business, governments are and laws are, in the business of legislating morality. Sometimes we overextend from the left and from the right, and we find people generally do the right kind of centering to put us back. When you find out that, say, cigarette smoke, as you brought up, secondhand smoke is dangerous, then I think you've got some scientific evidence, and perhaps it might be seeming to those people who like to smoke some imposition. But I also know someone who died of lung cancer, never smoked a day in their life, but seemed to have developed it from his parents, who were, you know, smokers, and he was exposed all his life to secondhand smoke. So maybe that's a good thing. I don't know what the overreach is, but to enshrine something in the Constitution, to make an amendment, that's a different thing.
How did, you've touched a little bit on this, but how did prohibition fail? And more importantly, I guess, what were the political activities that helped pull it out of the Constitution and end it?
Well, you know, first of all, it failed in its application. It was so unevenly and so unfairly applied. It was mostly working people who were the victims of it. The rich seemed to go away. You know, the President of the United States, Warren G. Harding, for prohibition, nevertheless had a whiskey cabinet that met every week, fueled by a bootlegger who brought in a whiskey to the White House. It's bound to fail when you have that kind of top-to-bottom systemic hypocrisy. The cop on the street is bribed, the prohibition agent is bribed, the sergeant at the desk is bribed, his captain is bribed, the judges are bribed, the senators are bribed, the assistant attorney generals are bribed. This is a corruption.
Now, wait, are you talking about now or prohibition?
I'm talking about prohibition. So I think what happens is that you see in 1928, 8 years into this, that the presidential candidate, the first person who dared speak up, Al Smith, a Catholic, which was already two or three or five or 10 strikes against him, yeah. but also a wet gets destroyed for both his Catholicism and his wet posture. But it opens the door and people start talking about it and people begin to realize how hypocritical this whole thing had been and the movement happens. The real turning point is the Depression. You say, okay, we got rid of the fifth largest industry for what reason? Mm-hmm. We don't have these jobs that we could use for what reason? And we don't benefit from this tax revenue for what reason? And I think right. just the sense that life was so hard in the Depression, we can't even appreciate it now, even in tough economic times, how bad it was in the Depression. It just seemed when Roosevelt came in within a week, beer was legal. And the repeal of the amendment, which went into effect, that is to say alcohol was available on December 5th, 1933, was almost anticlimactic, which is like, we gotta get going with something else. More important and kind of micromanaging people's lives, that if 10% of the population, whatever it is, that has a problem with alcohol, yeah. let's try to deal with that, but let's not superimpose the solution on 100% of the people.
Do you think it's an echo of that, but in today's marijuana legalization movement, so I mean, it seems to be tracking a lot of what was going on in Prohibition in the sense that there are now exceptions for medical marijuana,
yes.
as there were for medical applications. You see the need for new revenue. You see a normalizing or a mainstream of marijuana. NBA players love it. Rap stars love it. Everybody smokes it or has smoked it. We need revenue, things like that. Do you see this pushing forward?
Yeah, I think it will be incremental. And I think one of the things, marijuana, as we know, is the biggest cash crop in the United States, more than soybeans, right. more than wheat, more than corn.
And without subsidies, except the subsidy of the black market.
Exactly. And so you have that attractive sort of thought that states have, cash-strapped states and cash-strapped federal government, that its regulation and its taxation would help in the organized crime, the criminal aspect of it, but also to bring in revenues. But you also still have to consider what are the unintended consequences. Some kid asked me, I've been traveling around the country, he says, well, how would you test for driving while under the influence of marijuana? I mean, we now administer, and every cop is competent in administering a breathalyzer test, but are you going to take a blood sample and determine the level of THC to say this guy has no alcohol in his blood, but he's driving around? What do you do then? How do we regulate? How old are you to have access to it? What are some of the questions? These are only the superficial things, not knowing what that would do. And I think people, because it is drugs and you don't have that widespread human history that you have with alcohol, we've been fermenting, brewing, and distilling since there have been human beings. What will happen? It remains to be seen, but you do feel that there's been incremental difference. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where in the late 60s we had a $5 pot thing. It was like, you know, the meter running out. The cop caught you with less than an ounce, and it was a $5 ticket. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was like parking too long in a parking meter.
Right. And we seem to be coming back more to something like
yeah.
that.